Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Welcome to March in Minnesota. Did I miss something? Oh, excuse me. I don't know what it is about giving the talk that makes me froggy. It's my Dharma talk ritual. I want to talk today about I have to say, my voice gets really quiet, so if you can't hear me, just give me a little one of these, because it will go down.
I think this is a connection.
Is that better?
Yes.
Is that better? Okay. All right. One time, somebody talked to me afterwards and said, I didn't hear anything you said, and I felt so bad. So please, I'll feel a lot better if you let me know while I'm saying it. Okay. So I want to talk today about a list of 10 principles in the way of healing, and it comes from this book, Bringing Zen Home, The Healing Heart of Japanese Women's Rituals by Paula Arai. And I got it. It's in our library downstairs. A couple of weeks ago, Darla was returning it, and I looked at it and said, is that a good book? And she said, oh, yes. So thank you, Darla. Paula was here last spring. Some of you probably saw her. And if you ever had the chance to hear Paula Arai speak or to study with her, take it, because she is wonderful. I've seen her speak, I think, 3 times now, and she's just way up there on my list. Am I not talking loud enough? Oh, you have seen her.
I wonder if you could bring that mic in.
Bring it in closer? How about that? It'll bend like that? So? Okay. How's that better? Okay. So in this book, she talks about some pioneering research that she did with Japanese lay women. She's written in the past about Japanese nuns. She did a big study of Japanese nuns. And this book talks about a study that she did of Japanese lay women and how they express their Buddhism, how it shows up, or how it manifests in sort of the everyday ups and downs and shifting sands of their lives. And I was struck, as I read it, by how the most mundane activities were expressed as spiritual practices. You know, just the real everydayness of their lives turned out to be spiritual practices for them. And after very closely observing these women and talking with them over a period of time, Paula came up with a list of 10 principles that described what she had learned from them about the way they express their Buddha nature. And she gave examples, particularly in the first part of the book, she gave examples from their lives. So that got me thinking about people that I know, I think people that we all know, whose years of spiritual practice kind of shine right out of them. I think actually it does out of all of us, but there's some people in particular who we can really see that. So I want to offer some ways that we can nurture and express these principles in this culture and in our lives. There are a lot of interesting stories in here about how the Japanese lay women did, but today I'm going to talk about ways that we could do that. But first I want to say two things. I want to talk about healing and I want to talk about ritual. In this context, healing is not about curing an ailment. Paula says in the book, healing is about an orientation in life and is not about a narrow cause and effect process. Healing is not a result of action. It is rather a way of acting, seeing, thinking, and holding your heart. So there's a lot of heart practice in this. Madeleine L'Engle, a writer whose best-known book was A Wrinkle in Time, said, it is no coincidence that the root word of whole, health, heal and holy is hail, like in hale and hearty. She said, if we are healed, we become whole. We are hale and hearty. We are holy. So, or as one of the Japanese women in the study said very simply, I know I am healed when I am kind. I know I am healed when I'm kind. So that's healing. And the other word I wanted to talk about, the English word ritual, doesn't have a direct translation, apparently, into Japanese. So when Paula was talking to the women about how they expressed their spirituality in their lives, they had a hard time coming to a way of even talking about it because they didn't have a word for ritual. And she did find a word called saho that she translated as a way or a method of actualizing. So a method of actualizing. And she said, in their seamless worldview, many everyday activities are invested with a sense of importance, such as where to take off shoes and how to place them once they are off. I was just looking at our shoe rack out there, and it is a thing of beauty. Every pair of shoes out there is lined up except one, and that's our wabi-sabi pair. Taking off our shoes and lining them up is just a small thing, but it's a mindfulness practice. Tim talks about it, and I think the last chapter in his book, how his teacher got him to take a look at his shoes and what that said about the state of his mind. I think that, you know, it's such a mundane thing, but if you pay attention to how you take your shoes off, where you put them, and how you line them up, and do that for 15 or 20 years, you'll still be learning things from it. It's a really wonderful practice, or you might say ritual. So we might think of ritual as really formal activities, you know, like our formal Saturday service here at Zen Center. But in this context, what we're talking about is how we imbue everyday life experiences with meaning. So here are Paula's 10 principles in the way of healing. And these are on the front of your bulletin, too. Excuse me. So her 10 principles are experiencing interrelatedness, living body-mind, engaging in rituals, nurturing the self, enjoying life, creating beauty, cultivating gratitude, accepting reality as it is, expanding perspective, and embodying compassion. So let's talk a little bit about what those might look like, or what they could look like, or ways that you might want to think about those coming up in our lives here. The first one was experiencing interrelatedness. And, you know, we think of ourselves in really concrete terms, I think. You know, my name is Rosemary. I have this body. These are my life experiences. This is what I've made of myself. You know, here's how I present to other people. You know, it's such a... we don't even think about it. But I read a while ago, and this is probably something about Japanese people, because I probably read it in a book about Buddhism. I don't remember. But there was a culture where instead of thinking about themselves in that way, they thought of themselves as they are in relation to other people. So I might think, well, I'm Anne's daughter. I'm so-and-so's mother, so-and-so's wife. I'm a niece. I'm an aunt. I'm a teacher, I'm a student, so it's all in relation to everyone else. And when we think of it that way, it really, I think, dissolves those boundaries that we have. It really dissolves that fixed idea of who we are. And we feel a greater sense of sort of connectedness and interdependence with other people. It's a really good exercise to do when you find yourself really feeling alone, or when you feel yourself kind of hardening around a point of view, particularly if you're feeling defensive or self-righteous. It's a really good thing to just stop and do. So let's try this right now. Let's take 30 seconds. I'll watch the time, so you don't have to. So just take a half a minute and think about all the ways that you are in relationship with other people. Think about family relationship, neighbors, supervisor, employee, all the different ways. And then when you've done that, you can just say hello to all those people and thank them, and maybe offer a little intention to do your best in your relationship with them. Ever since I read about that, I just stop and do it once in a while. It changes your idea of self. The second one is living body-mind. And this means body-mind as one, that mind and body, between mind and body, there's no separation. And a really foundational practice for this in Buddhism is watching the breath, which is kind of the mama of all healing rituals. It comes from the Sutra on the Mindfulness of Breathing, which Susan led a study group on here this fall. What's the Sanskrit name for that sutra? Anapanasati Sutra. Thank you. The Sanskrit names just drop right out of my head, and then they're gone. They roll away across the floor. So we had a study group on this, and last year when I led Rahatsu Sishin Buddha's Enlightenment Retreat in Atlanta, we studied that sutra for all 7 days of the retreat. And the breath is really useful because, number one, it's always with us, and also because watching it tells us a lot about what's going on in our bodies, particularly with our emotions. It's a very simple practice, but it's always accessible. So at any time, you can just stop and watch your breath. I mean, we talk about if you get angry, counting to 10. This is sort of the Buddhist version of that. So why don't we stop and just take 3 breaths and just really thoroughly watch those breaths as you take them. Breathe in, breathe out. You can do that anytime. And when you do, just stop and see what it is that you're feeling in your body. And particularly if we're feeling an afflictive emotion, you know, if we're feeling anxiety or loneliness or something, this is one of those instances where the experience itself is also the cure, you know, breathing in. I'm feeling what I'm feeling, and breathing out, I'm letting it go. So, living body-mind. The third one is engaging in rituals. And I want to tell you about 25 years ago or so, I used to catch the bus every morning and go to work every day downtown. And I lived 4 houses from the end of the block. And so I'd walk every morning down to the end of the block, and there would be the bus, and I'd catch the same bus every morning. And one morning, in particular, I remember getting about 2 houses down and seeing the bus going by, and I thought, oh, geez, you know, everybody knows that feeling. Oh. And then the bus didn't even get across the intersection, and it stopped. And I thought, cool. So I ran up and hopped on the bus and thanked the bus driver and asked him why he stopped, because it didn't occur to me that he had stopped for me. And he said, well, you know, I see you on this corner every morning, and so if you're not there, I slow down and look down the street to see if you're there. And I could not believe it. You know, if you had asked me before that day about the bus driver, I could have maybe told you what he looked like. And my impression probably would have been something like, he's quiet, not friendly, maybe even a little bit grumpy. So it really moved me to think that he was doing that for me and probably all of his regular riders. And so because of that, I have taken up a really mundane ritual. It's so mundane that I didn't even realize it was a ritual until this week when I was thinking about this talk. And that's that every time I get on the bus, every time since then, for 25 years, I look at the bus driver. I look at the bus driver's face, and I say hi. And then get off the bus saying thank you. And it seems like such a tiny thing, but when I lived in New York, I promise you people didn't do that. And it's the kind of tiny ritual that just has little ripple effects into your life. Just little ripple effects. So if you don't think of yourself as being a ritual kind of person, I would invite you to check again, because I'll bet you have little rituals like that that seem so insignificant and so routine, you might, you know, call them a habit, but they enhance your life in a way that's so underneath the river that we don't really even understand them. So, going back to Saho, you know, it's a method of actualizing. These little daily rituals are a method of actualizing, and they're how we imbue our everyday life experiences with meaning. Nurturing the self. So Pema Chodron talks about developing an unconditional friendship with yourself. And the first step of that is directing a feeling of gentleness and kindness inward to yourself, with the kind of compassion that you ordinarily reserve for other people and other people that you like, or other people who you would like to think well of you, you know. An unconditional friendship, as she explains it, takes courage, because it means that we have to look deeply at ourselves and we need to stay present even when we're noticing the embarrassing things that we think and do and the painful things that come up, and look at those with a sort of open and forgiving heart, which I find is much easier to do with other people than with myself. But it's sort of knowing all your little tricks and calling yourself on them, but doing it kindly and maybe with a little bit of a sense of humor. And the reason that's important that we do that is because we live in an uncertain world and we have work to do. And we aren't going to be a whole lot of help to other people or to the world if we can't bring our responses up naturally from our own hearts and from our own experiences. You know, if we can't see ourselves clearly with a loving and forgiving heart, even when we're trying to wiggle out of doing what we need to do, then we won't be able to help anybody else. You know, one of the bodhisattva vows that we chant at the end of our time together here as beings are numberless, vowing to free them. And means vowing to help them. And all beings deserve our very best self. And we do too. So that's what nurturing the self is for. The next one is enjoying life. Number five is enjoying life. And this doesn't necessarily mean seeking out ways of being entertained, although it can. Paula says, with a supple and flexible body-mind, you can enjoy life without setting conditions on what you need to experience joy. You can enjoy life without setting conditions on what you need to experience joy. So we don't need to wait until we have all our ducks in a row. We don't need to wait until things are the way that we would like them ordinarily to be. I think we can make a decision about enjoying life. Like I said, we live in unnerving times, and yet we aren't really whole unless we're enjoying life. So this one is really intertwined with the next two, creating beauty and cultivating gratitude. Number six, creating beauty. I also added for myself, creating and appreciating beauty. Because if you think about it, appreciating beauty is creating beauty. Now, we have these beautiful flowers that Mary Beth did the other day. She created that beauty, and by appreciating it, I'm creating it again. I was reading a story, an article this week by Darlene Cohen, who was a Zen teacher, who spent a good chunk of her life, her adult life, with rheumatoid arthritis. And then she developed a really serious form of cancer. And she talks in this article about what happened after her first round of chemo, which was, I guess, pretty brutal. Here's what she said. She was talking about what a miserable thing it was to go through the chemo. And she said, simultaneous to that misery was the most beautiful autumn I'd ever seen in my life, happening right outside my room in a grove of maples and redwoods. The slanting light, characteristic of Northern California autumns, dramatically showcased the reds, golds, apricots, and browns of the evolving plants. As dawn broke each morning, sunbeams penetrated the windows along my eastern wall, progressively highlighting the dark wood of my chair and table, the threads of my blanket, the reds and blues of my rug, and my waiting body. So, I thought that was pretty remarkable that in her great discomfort and probably fear, what she noticed was beauty. When things get tough, a wonderful practice is to check for beauty. And if things are so tough that you can't find it anywhere, one place you can always find it is in the sky. My mom has, she's from South Dakota, and they have a lot of sky there. And so she will just stop in the middle of anywhere and say, look at the clouds, look at the sky, it is so beautiful. And she's absolutely right. If you can't find beauty anywhere else, you can always look up. Even on a day like this, when you look out and you think, well, I can't see very much sky, but absolutely you can. And it's beautiful. Even when there's fog and you think, I don't see the sky, it's right there. And if you look at it with appreciating eyes, you'll see that beauty. So appreciating beauty, it's a very important part of our spiritual lives. Number seven is cultivating gratitude. And Joanna Macy, who is a Buddhist teacher and ecologist, said, the great open secret of gratitude is that it is not dependent on external circumstance. I love that. Gratitude is not dependent on external circumstance. It's more of an attitude or a habit energy within us. Blanche Hartman was she's a former abbess of San Francisco Zen Center, and she's also a great sewing teacher in this country. And she wrote an article once about a traditional meditation that to cultivate gratitude that they were taught by a visiting Tibetan teacher. And it involved thinking of everything that is ours and considering how it came to us. Anybody recognize that? Anybody who was in Rahatsu recognize those words? That's part of our meal chant. We consider how it came to us. So the meditation involves thinking about everything we have, everything that we own, and then thinking about the people whose lives and generosity and activities provided those for us. So you can start with what you have on and what you have with you right now. You can start with the meditation cushion, you know, and go out to our food, our clothes, you know, our books, the place we live, our health. And remember that everything that we have comes to us through the kindness and the activities of other people. So let's just take a moment and close your eyes and take an inventory of everything that you brought with you today, everything that you have on you, maybe everything you left out on the coat rack. Just take an inventory. And as you walk through them, as you walk through your socks and your earrings and your raksu, remind yourself, these things all came to me through the kindness and activities of other people. When we think about our worldly goods in that way, how can we be anything other than grateful or generous? How can we be anything other than grateful and generous? Another practice for generating generosity that I really like is to write down at the end of each day. Just write down as quickly as you can one page or maybe five or six things that happened that day that you're grateful for, things that you received that day or saw or experienced that day that you're grateful for. If you do that every day, you would not believe how it will increase your capacity for gratitude. I took that practice up, and I remember to do it about once every 10 days or so. So someday I'm looking forward to having gratitude for my great memory. But I think it might be gratitude for at one time in my life having had a good memory. But that's a wonderful practice, and it's a very easy one to do. Principle number 8 is accepting reality as it is. And this is a very foundational aspect of Buddhist practice. You know, causes and conditions have all come together, you know. Karma has come together from beginningless time to create this moment just as it is. And the question is, what am I going to do about it? What am I going to do right now? What's my response? Another line in the Bodhisattva vow that we're going to chant soon is, Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Dharma gates are boundless. This is my favorite line in that chant, I think. Dharma gates are boundless. It means every moment, every moment, every moment is a Dharma gate. And vowing to enter them. I'm standing in this gate. Causes and conditions have come together. This is the way things are. What am I going to do about it? What am I going to do about it? Pema Children says, every moment is an opportunity to either open up or shut down, to wake up or try to run. So I think accepting reality as it is, plus a little bit of imagination, results in the next one, number 9, which is expanding perspective. A few weeks ago, we had one of our country's favorite national pastimes, which was Black Friday. Day after Thanksgiving, it's the busiest shopping day of the year. Now it's leaking into Thanksgiving, which I really hate. I hate Black Friday. I hate that it comes right after Thanksgiving. I just can't stand anything about it. I don't go to the stores because they're crazies. I just stay home and I'm kind of grouchy and self-righteous about it. So that's my perspective. Is Randy here this morning? I don't see Randy. Good that I can talk about him. One of our Sangha members recently came up with the idea that we would host an event here the day after Thanksgiving called Blank Friday. And it involved people coming together. On the third floor, people were meditating together all day. People would come and go. They were meditating. We had several presentations here in the Zendo about meditation. The sewing group was sewing downstairs in the library. It was a place to come for that day where you could do sort of the opposite of Black Friday events. And it was wonderful. And we had a great logo for it too. There was a drawing of somebody with a shopping cart, and sitting on top of the shopping cart was an Enso. You know, it stands for nothing. So that was our Blank Friday. And hearing about that just really opened up the idea of Black Friday for me, and reminded me that just because that's the way that it's celebrated everywhere doesn't mean that my only reaction to it can be to sulk and be self-righteous. It opened it up. And with any kind of luck, I'll be able to remember that about whatever the next holiday like that is. The last one, number 10, is embodying compassion. And here's the quote I found on compassion. It's from Tara Brach, who's a meditation teacher and writer. And she said, compassion is the spacious quality of heart that allows and holds with tenderness whatever you and others are experiencing. I added the "and others." So, compassion is the spacious quality of heart. I love words like spacious and quality of heart. That allows and holds with tenderness whatever you and others are experiencing. So this one is also related to accepting reality as it is, right? And when we accept reality as it is, we naturally want to help. And sometimes the only way that we can help is to be with other people. You know, sometimes there really isn't anything we can actively do about it. And the best thing we can offer is just to be there. You know. There are a number of heart-opening practices that I think have been talked about a number of times here in the Zendo by various people, and it would take another whole Dharma talk to really give instructions on them. But I can kind of give you a quick view of one of them that we can do either while we're meditating, while we're on the cushion, or while we're out and about in the world. You know, so imagine you are in a hospital waiting room, and while we're in that hospital waiting room, we can sit there and worry and chew our fingernails, or we can read old issues of People magazine. Another thing that we can do is while we're sitting there in the middle of that, surrounded by other people who are also waiting and probably feeling a little unnerved, is that we can open our hearts to all the millions of people around the world who are also in that same situation, where they're concerned about someone who they care about a great deal. Excuse me. And then we can send them a little bit of loving kindness. We can just send out, using our imagination and our minds, we can send out a little loving kindness. And when I teach this, I always have to say that I have no idea whether that loving kindness that we send out has any effect on anybody else's life. You know, I don't know if it makes anybody else feel better. But what I do know is that doing those kind of practices will increase our own capacity for compassion without fail. I give a money back guarantee on that one. Double your money back guarantee on that one. It's just true. If we're waiting for our kid to come home and it's midnight and they have the car and they were supposed to be home by 11:30, you know, instead of stewing about it, we can just stop for a minute in the middle of our stewing and think about all the other people, inconceivable numbers of people around the world who are concerned about someone who they don't know where they are, you know, in any circumstance, people that we can't even imagine. And we can send our hearts out to them. And when we do that routinely, it becomes a practice, it becomes a ritual, and it'll make our compassion stronger. And then the next time that we run into somebody who's in pain or who just looks like there's something going on, you know, we can think, I haven't been in your particular situation, but I know what it feels like to feel pain, to feel concern, to feel worry. And I can be there with you in whatever it is that's happening in your life. I can be there with you totally and fully without having to even know what it is. I can just be there with you. And the way that we do that is by developing our own compassionate abilities. We can be there with somebody else no matter what. So those are some examples of what those principles might look like. And I'll bet that some of you have more examples or ideas of what that might be like. And I'd like to hear them. Does anybody have anything they want to add to that, or experiences that they've had in their lives or seen, been inspired by maybe? Challenges? All the speakers who have ever been up here and heard that silence. It used to unnerve me. Thank you. Hello.
So, on the question of gratitude.
Yeah.
I was thinking about material stuff, the clothes I'm wearing, my iPhone, my hearing aids, the car I drove here in, produced by the generosity and activity of others, but also that included, in many cases, a lot of pain, which is hidden from us. What can you do about that?
It's another opportunity for compassion. It is, and it's another opportunity, frankly, for awareness of whether we really need this particular thing. Your hearing aids, absolutely, you know? the other newest, shiniest doodad, maybe not so much. But keeping that in mind is absolutely a way of seeing reality as it is and developing compassion and also watching our patterns in life. Yeah, back there in the back.
I just returned from the International Science Talk from Paris.
Oh, you did?
On Friday, when they had released the second draft, and there was just a lot of tension, and there's a lot of angst over, you know, the terminology and the wording. And I was in the green zone, which is 100 to thousands of people. And in the midst of all of this, there was a Buddhist monk who was doing a walking meditation.
Uh-huh.
And people just started joining in. And it was just so beautiful to just see this, like, it just brought the tension down so much. And just, people just started following in behind him. And it was really beautiful to behold. And, I think it's just some of the things that we talked about that it really just helped. Just an appreciation and a gentleness and a humanity that was really lovely to behold.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. You know, it's really important that when we are doing any kind of social action, that we bring a sense of mindfulness, we bring a sense of joy, and that we bring that kind of calm demeanor to it, I think. Somebody asked Reb Anderson one time, they were going to a war protest, and they wanted to know. And I think specifically it was directed at the president that we had at that time. And they wanted to know how they should conduct themselves at that. And he said, you can go, but don't go angry. You know, project something other than anger. And, you know, so thank you. Thank you for going to that. Yeah. There was somebody else over there who had something, I think. Oh, yeah.
Well, my daughter spends a lot of time in the room. She's not a whole lot on her cell phone.
Yeah.
And she's not that open to suggestions.
Yeah.
I really try and activate her a little bit.
Yeah.
But I've run out of patience with her, and I kind of don't like myself for it, because I should be more patient and compassionate. But it's like at some point you just, you know, get out of that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really know. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Is she a teenager?
Yeah, she's 12.
She's 12. Oh. Yeah. That's going to happen. Yeah.
May I comment?
Sure.
I'm going to start.
Yeah.
I think around that time myself, I kind of drew in, and there was a lot of confusion about. There's a lot of confusion for me personally, and 12 is a hard age. You're in middle school, kids aren't that nice. They kind of that hideaway into social media. Mm-hmm. So kind of just be there for them, mm-hmm. and just keep asking, like, "Oh, like, how are you doing?" And they may not open up, but eventually they will. Who is having that patience and understanding that they must be making change. Mm-hmm. They just don't know how they should be feeling or how to confront it.
Yeah.
But I think compassion is really important.
Thank you. I'm a parent of two former teenagers myself, and I don't want to name names, but those were really hard years. They were just, you know, they were just really hard. And I think, like you said, remembering that they are in pain too. My son went into his cave for a number of years. And the senior year of one of my former teenagers, whose name will not be mentioned, was probably the hardest year of my life. And now they are absolutely lovely 28 and 30 year olds, and that doesn't help you now. But it does pass. It does. Yeah.
So, being grateful, I've been told that when I vocalize some of those thoughts, I'm being annoying.
What thoughts? About being grateful?
Right.
People find that annoying.
Yes. Just an example. I've had with my teenagers.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is going to be a teenager story, isn't it? Oh, Mom, you're so grateful all the time.
I'm exhausted. And we'll get in the car, and I'll say, I'm so grateful for having a car. I'm so grateful that my car, I can sit down and relax and bring myself home. I can't imagine doing what we just did and being exhausted and getting on a bus and trying to get home. I'm really grateful that this car. And or I'll be on packaging something and I'll think to myself, I thought there was a child that packaged it. I thought there was a child somewhere in the world that tied all these ties and sealed this in plastic wrap. And I'm just so grateful that my children don't have to have that life. And I've been told that when I express those thoughts that I'm annoying I don't want to hear that. I don't want, you only want to talk about things that are real. Why can't you just tell me what your feelings are? And so being, verbalizing that gratefulness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I hope this is true for you too. As they got into college, both of my former teenagers who won't be named thanked us for some of those very things out loud. So I was, in my 40s at some point, and I thought, what a wonderful thing. So I actually went and thanked my mom for a few of those. It had never occurred to me, but my children are better people than I am. So do it anyway. Do it anyway. Don't do it in public. Even when their eyes are rolling, do it anyway, because it may not look right now like it's sinking in, but on some level it is. I think. Anybody else? All right, so we have some announcements and some squeak in the...